Last week, attorneys for a 15-year-old biological male from West Virginia argued in front of the U.S. Supreme Court and challenged a state law that kept biological boys off of girls' sports teams. Last year, the same court upheld the right of states to block gender transitions of minors. And also, President Trump issued an executive order early last year declaring that for federal purposes, there are only two genders, male and female. Now, clearly, there's been strong pushback against the gender ideology regime. But does anything more need to be done to protect women's sports or the biological integrity of minors? Joining us to talk further is Bernadette Broyles, the founder of the Child and Parental Rights Campaign, which is a public interest law firm that protects children's health, defends parental rights, and secures women's privacy, safety, and equal opportunities against the harms of transgender ideology. Bernadette, welcome to the Commonwealth Matters.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. It's so good to be with you, Richard.
Yeah. Hey, we appreciate what you're doing with the Child and Parental Rights Campaign. We got to know each other a little bit recently, became familiar with your work last year sometime, and about some of the resources that you put together. But I'd like to steel man, if I could, some of the arguments that the other side puts forward that would defend boys who identify as girls to play on the girls' sports teams. The idea that gender dysphoric children should be allowed to pursue the gender that they feel comfortable with, and also the idea of parental rights. And so I want to, first of all, we're going to start with the Parental Rights Campaign. That's part of your name, right? But there are critics out here. I've seen them in person. I'm sure you've seen them. There are some critics who contend that your group infringes on parental rights, not upholds them, but infringes on parental rights. And here's an example. There was a case in Montana that banned gender mutilation of minors. It was the Van Gardner family. And they said that taking away this crucial medical care is a violation of our rights. I'd like you to address that. Is that a violation of parental rights?
No, because the law has long been established, this is not even a close one, that parents do not have the right to harm their children. Child protection and child welfare is a fundamental interest of any state. And parents, while they have a core set of rights to their custody, their care, and so forth, it's constrained by the best interest of the child, always. So parents do not have carte blanche right to do just anything to their child, to harm their child. For instance, in many states, there are laws against genital mutilation. So no, parents, even in the practice of the religion, cannot take their daughters to have their genitals mutilated, okay, because of some ideology. That's just one example. There are many examples. Many parents cannot give alcohol to their children beneath a certain age. Parents cannot unilaterally allow them to drive beneath a certain age and other adult responsibilities, decisions that could, you know, do them harm. So this is just part, what Montana and other states have done is part and parcel of putting constraints on the decision-making of parents that would foreclose the future of their own children, that could potentially lead their children to not be able to have children of their own someday, and other physiological and psychological harms that the state is protecting them against. That is an appropriate state action to constrain the decision-making of parents. And quite frankly, most parents are being deceived and coerced by this sliver of the medical community endorsing this ideology. So frankly, it actually protects the decision-making of parents so that parents are not getting false and fraudulent information and coercive pressures to say, if you don't do this, your child is going to commit suicide. That's coercion. So at the end of the day, it actually improves parental decision-making and it safeguards the welfare and the well-being of children.
Bernadette, thank you for giving a detailed response to that. I think it's important that we address some of the fundamental arguments that those on the other side have. Parents, listen to these medical organizations. They want to know what their pediatrician is saying and what the professional organization is saying about gender-affirming care. The medical organizations are talking about gender-affirming care. First of all, address that. Is it gender-affirming care?
Absolutely. Okay, several things. First of all, I never use the term gender-affirming care ever anymore because you're not affirming anything. Gender, if it's divorced from sex, it has literally no meaning. It has no substrate in the body. It has no location in the body. It has no genesis that we can track. It has no biological component to it. It is a made up concept. And so therefore, no, you're not affirming anything that has any physiological reality. So what we call it, and what the frankly, a group of us have been able to successfully convince the administration to call it, is sex rejecting procedures. This is about psychologically and socially rejecting your sex. And that's what these procedures do, because it is physiologically impossible to ever change sex. And that's why the Trump administration has begun to identify these treatments as a form of consumer fraud, when you have doctors that are, in essence, claiming that a child or young person can change their sex, number one. Number two, as far as these organizations are concerned, and pediatricians, in fact, most pediatricians that the average parent will encounter will actually not endorse these treatments. Most will say, and in significant part because of intimidation, you know what? I don't have any expertise on this. Let me refer you, or why don't you look up a specialist on this, a gender specialist. And it's a relative sliver of the medical community that is endorsing and actively promoting these treatments, but more importantly, the major medical associations. I've litigated this in court. I've had judges say to me, to my face, and I was, by the way, involved in that Montana litigation. I was working CPRC, Child Parental Rights Campaign. We worked with the Montana Attorney General's office, so I know exactly what you're talking about. And so, yes, most of the major medical associations have endorsed these mistreatments. However, what has happened is that, in truth, their membership hasn't endorsed these treatments. It is a small sliver of the leadership of the, you know, guideline committee and of the board, small. I mean, we're talking less than two dozen typically doctors that have become ideologically captured and financially captured by the multi-billion dollar pharmaceutical industry that stands to make an obscene amount of profit on the backs and the bodies of these children. You convince one child, say starting at the age of 14, 13, that she is actually a male stuck in a female body. And so therefore, for the rest of her life, she is now a captured medical patient that otherwise was healthy. All right. It first of all will shorten her life. It will shorten her life. But for whatever her shortened life is, she is now a captured medical servant to the pharmaceutical industry that she will be paying, or an insurance industry will be paying, or and to her doctor. And she will probably pay, I think it's at least a couple of million, $1.5 million, one child. Multiply that by an endless supply of young girls. So between the profit-making motives of the pharmaceutical industry and the ideological and political motivation of those that have captured our major medical associations, it has been a toxic combination. And that's why we are not seeing truth coming out of them. But that's going to change before too long, because there's tremendous amount of pressure that's being placed on them.
Brenda, that I'm aware of some lawsuits against medical practices where minors have been operated on, double mastectomies, high levels of hormones. Were these young people? I know some personally. I've met them, talked with them. Their bodies are wrecked. They're in their early 20s now, and there are lawsuits moving ahead. What's the status of those? Are there any lawsuits, I'll ask it this way, any lawsuits in favor of the detransitioners who are experiencing significant bodily harm?
Yeah. Oh, yes. In fact, I was about to be interviewed by a reporter on this. There are well over 20 lawsuits by detransitioners against their either mental health providers or the medical providers because of the harm that they have done. So Child and Parental Rights Campaign, you had asked me about that earlier. Forgive me if I didn't answer your question. We are a group of, at this point, four lawyers going on five, located in four different states. Georgia, to begin with, that's our headquarters. Virginia, Kentucky, Missouri, and we've just offered to a young lady in Louisiana. Our staff is entirely in Georgia. Our lawsuits are around the country. We sue school districts. That's been our primary lawsuits, who have secretly transitioned minor children at school without the knowledge of their parents, and at times, literally over the parental objection. Perhaps later on, we might want to talk about two of our lawsuits that are being considered as we speak by the Supreme Court of the United States. But one of the things that we've done a variety of things including defending female sports, but in the area you just talked about, to uphold these bans on these sex-rejecting procedures. We worked with about 7 attorney general's offices to help defend their laws, including the Scrimeti case that was just decided by the Supreme Court. In that capacity, we brought to bear the testimony of a number of brave detransitioners. I was just with Precia Mosley. I was just with Chloe Cole yesterday at the Supreme Court, and many, many others, Zoe Haas and others. They are pressing their lawsuits. Chloe Cole's lawsuit is moving to trial next year. She and I were together yesterday. We were chatting and talking. The lawsuits are beginning to break through. They are beginning to break through. And this is going to be part, it'll be one of the spears that takes this monster down. In addition, the Federal Trade Commission has identified these practices as potential medical fraud. And we're working with an ally to tee up a complaint on that regard by a medical association. So in due course, this monster will come down, but it's a lot of work.
There's a proverb that says, when a land transgresses, it has many rulers. But with a man of understanding and knowledge, its stability will long continue. The idea here is that when people live without regard to their neighbors and without moral boundaries, then you need more government to restrain people who've gone off the rails. So if people are going to flourish, God's truth must be embraced. After all, God tells us who we are, what's our purpose, and how to live in harmony with our fellow man. Christians should understand what God's word says and how to think biblically about the issues so that they can engage well. To stay up to date with what's going on in Kentucky, subscribe to CPC's newsletter. Go to commonwealthpolicycenter.org to subscribe, and you can also find other resources there. Thank you, and may God bless you.
That came out in NPR, of all places, about Seattle Public Schools facilitating the gender transitions of minors. Here's what the first paragraph of the story says. Seattle Public Schools launched a program earlier this year, that was early 2025, in collaboration with Seattle Children's Hospital to provide gender-affirming products such as chest binders, trans tape, nipple guards, and tucking underwear to middle and high school students to use at will, newly obtained internal documents reveal. Bernadette, are you involved with this case in Seattle?
I'm not involved with the case in Seattle. Seattle, Washington is probably the worst in the country. Seattle and Oregon, I'd say followed by Illinois, California and Illinois, but probably the worst laws and practices. But the paradigm of what you're talking about, we're very, very familiar with because we actually encountered it in a red state. So you're talking about a unethical and extraordinarily destructive and deceptive collaboration scheming between a local pediatric center and local schools. And I would add to that, without a doubt, there is no question that that scheme is involving the court system, the juvenile court system, the judges in that community, and almost certainly the social workers of their child protective services, because that is what we're finding. And we even found that in a red state, not the worst of the worst in Washington. So what we encountered in Missouri, we represented whistleblower Jamie Reed, and she shared with us she worked at the Pediatric Gender Center for the Washington University St. Louis Pediatric Gender Center. In that capacity, however, she then cross-pollinated and would do trainings to the local schools to promote this ideology and trainings to the local judiciary, juvenile court judges and social workers in CPS. That's why I'm making these assertions. That's in deep red Missouri. She outed all of this. So that is the conflagration of those who are scheming together to deprive us of our children and to influence our children to so radicalize into this ideology that the child themselves become the activist against their own parents. And Richard, let me just say this last thing before you go on to your next question, is that what you and I are trying to do desperately is to sound an appropriate alarm to how deep these roots go, how sophisticated this agenda is, and widespread it is, and just what these parents are up against, and they have no idea when their child is accessed, just how orchestrated and funded the agenda is against the basic family and the parent-child relationship, which is why you and I are here talking today.
Bernadette, is Seattle an outlier? You mentioned St. Louis. You mentioned Illinois. Is it just in our big cities, or should parents in rural Kentucky be concerned about gender ideology that's being introduced into the classroom? Should they be concerned about it in, I'm in Frankfort, Kentucky, the population of, it's population of 30,000. Should we be concerned about that here, or in other middle America, if you will?
We received a call about a year ago, no, a little less than a year ago, in the spring of 2025. From a couple, the wife is a practicing physician. The husband is a professor, temporarily lost their child to Child Protective Services here. And it started with the child rejecting her sex at school and secrets being kept at school. And the child finding a glitter family, I call it, it's a glitter family, a family who is willing to endorse the deception and take her in through school.
And I think that should be a wake-up call to parents across the country to be aware of what is going on in their child's public schools, what's being taught, what their counselors are saying, and then definitely if there are any kind of transitioning programs going on behind the scenes. I'm glad to say, by the way, that in Kentucky, that is illegal. You cannot do that as a public school official, guidance school counselor. You cannot do that here in Kentucky. There are consequences for that. Bernadette, for the sake of time, I want to move on. And I appreciate you bearing with me as we go at a pretty fast pace here. But I want to go to something that you all created. It's a church resource guide called Church Transgender Response Guide. And I commend you for doing that. I want to talk about the role of churches in this. But before I go to my question, this is what you say in the Church Transgender Response Guide. We're in a moment of time like few others. The cultural evangelists of our time are leading children and young people to embrace a powerful ideology, teaching them to believe that they can be born into the wrong body. This ideology is being proselytized through the internet and in classrooms and counselors' offices around the country, very often without the knowledge or approval of their parents. More alarming still is how this ideology is leading to the rising number of children and young people being irreversibly altered by medical interventions that distort their natural physical development. You go on to talk about those interventions, and then you go on to say that children and young people have the fundamental human right to know that their sex is a gift from God and not a disease. They have the right to experience natural growth and healthy development in harmony with their body, to have children of their own someday, and to experience healthy sexual function. Parents possess the fundamental right to direct the education, training, and care of their children. And they have the sacred responsibility to pass on to their children the timeless truths that will guard the next generation's emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is the introduction to the guide that you have prepared for churches. So I'm going to start with this. What is the role of churches in addressing gender dysphoria with young people?
Candidly, Richard, there is no institution in the United States that has a bigger role than the church on this issue. I want to right now debunk the notion. I don't mind acknowledging at all that I am a Christian. And so I am a disciple of Christ, and I believe in the words of Christ. And so I'm not speaking to that aspect of your audience that is also of people of faith. I'm not speaking from outside that faith. I'm speaking from within, as well as being an attorney who addresses this in court. And I want to dismantle a deception. And those ministers and leaders that are hearing me, please pay careful attention. There has been a deception that has been sold to you in order to silence you, in order to get you to self-censor. And that deception is to say, and to use language to say, that this issue is political and politics is dirty and is evil. And there's really no, and the church should be leaving that alone. That's filthy lucre. That is somehow outside the purview of what you should be spending your time on. That is deception. First of all, this is a governmental issue. The reason why this ideology has become so ascendant and so progressed in its being injected into our schools, into our public schools, and into our medical industrial complex is because it was promoted by our federal government. and by now by our state governments, by force of law, and with the backing of millions and billions of federal and state dollars behind it. It was a governmental agenda, and these are governmental schools. So number one, who made government? According to the book of Romans, government was made by God. The book of Isaiah says, and the government shall be upon Christ's shoulders. So if government is something that God made, then by all means, we, the people of God, and those who believe in God, need to be preserving it and ensuring that it operates in a way that is certainly not contrary to the very created order of God Almighty. Number one. Number two, this isn't a matter of fundamental truth. When you're able to force people to leave, to believe by force of government policies and intimidation that black is white, white is black, then male, it can be female, and female can be male, which is a obvious lie, then that government can force people to believe really almost any lie. Mm. And so who more than any other entity holds truth in our hands, and certainly the truth of the created order of the male, of the human species? It is the church. It is the church that has the book of Genesis. It is the church that has the book of Matthew, in which Jesus said they were created male and female. And so therefore, the role of the church to speak the truth into this issue is no greater. There is no institution that has a greater responsibility and opportunity. And then finally, where do a vast majority still of most Americans get their community from? Is from churches. The vast majority of parents, not all, by any stretch, but community is coming through churches. And so the church is the one place of solace, of truth, of support, of advocacy for these parents that have almost every other major institution of our culture is against them. Medical professionals telling them they have to transition or their child will commit suicide. Schools who are doing things literally behind their back, the entertainment industry that is promoting this at every possible turn. We already talked about government. And that's just to name a few. So what is the one institution left that parents can go to, they can trust their children to, they can go to for help to speak truth to their young people, or they can go to for help when their child has got sucked into this, or Child Protective Services shows up, or there's ideology coming into their community that needs to be opposed? It should be their church, their ministers, their pastors that are standing with them.
Bernadette, that is well said. How do people get involved with that network of churches? Let's say there's a pastor or maybe a youth leader listening. How do they get involved or more information there? And then how do they get more of your materials as well?
Sure. All right. So we have here the School Transgender Response, Navigating the Transgender Landscape School Response Guide. We created this 5 years ago for educators to have biology-based policies within their schools and their school districts. That's our first resource. And now what you mentioned was, I was reaching for that. That's why you saw me squirming a minute ago. Our church Transgender Response Guide is this one. And then we have two smaller resources, which is, one is what parents need to know in dealing with Child Protective Services. That's when CPS shows up at your door. And I tell you, the first hour is the most important of how you respond as to whether you're going to lose your child or not. What parents need to know in dealing with school officials, how do you assert your parental authority when you have school districts, school officials literally treating you as if you're an afterthought in your child's upbringing, and as if they know better than you do. All of these resources, and we provided you, I believe, a graphic that you can share with those, can be found on our website. But in addition to that, we have now begun to work with wonderful organizations like the Commonwealth Policy Institute and those who have church networks to reach out and make these resources, particularly the church guide, available to pastors, to churches around the country. And in addition to that, and which, of course, you know, Richard, we make available to you and those who are with you, we now are providing training to those who want to gather, whether it's to have us come out to their church or to a gathering of ministers or on the, you know, by Zoom, that we can provide training to kind of get into the nuts and bolts of how do you do this within your church community. I will say briefly that our church guide covers four basic areas. The first, and it's broken down by chapter, so it's almost like curriculum in itself. The first is the larger phenomenon of sex rejection or transgender identification, where is it coming from? Social media, what's happening in our schools, the medical aspect, the mental health aspect, the suicide lie, etc. The second chapter is towards ministers. How do you speak truth to your congregation? How do you protect your own church? How do you legally protect your church? There are things that churches can do to actually legally protect themselves while still standing for biological reality and truth. The third is to parents. Parents, how do you protect your children? How do you inoculate them? How do you help them if they have been bitten by this deception? How do you deal with your schools, etc.? And finally, the fourth is speaking to the young people themselves. I wrote that chapter in teaching young people how to stand up for truth themselves. So these resources would be available, again, on our website, and the graphics will be, I think, available to you, but also through our friends and partners like the Commonwealth Policy Center that we will be delighted to hopefully be working with to make these resources available.
Bernadette Broyles, founder of the Child and Parental Rights Campaign, thank you for joining us in the Commonwealth Matters. Thank you for standing in the gap and providing these wonderful resources to parents and to church leaders. And we do look forward to working with you in the future. God bless you, and may you keep up the good work.
God bless you as well. Thank you, Richard.